Welcome to Arts Impact Chats, the podcast diving into the personal and professional side of culture. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Arts Impact Chats, the new podcast from Arts and Culture Finance, where we talk to inspiring leaders in our network about the personal and professional side of culture. My name is Siva Phillips and I'm your host. To give you some background on Arts and Culture Finance, we're an impact investment fund manager, taking investment from public, private and philanthropic funders and then lending those funds to social purpose organizations, which in our case are those in the creative and cultural sector. Over the last 8 years, we've had the pleasure to work with many cultural leaders across a range of art forms and business models, and their experiences are exactly what we'd like to showcase through this podcast. Today's guest is Nicole Herbert-Wood, the CEO of Second Floor Studios and Arts, which is a provider of affordable artist workspace in London and the South East. Nicole has a background in economics and began her career in the corporate sector, but since 2010, she's been working on a number of ventures in the arts, developing particular expertise in the management and delivery of studio space. She's very much embedded in that world, and outside of her day job is involved with London's Affordable Artist Studio Network, and has also been part of the GLA's Workspace Advisory Group between 2018 and 2021. In 2019, Nicole was able to take a very minor break from her studio work by taking part in the inaugural cohort for the Executive Masters in Cultural Leadership delivered by the Royal Academy of Arts and Maastricht University. My conversation with Nicole was recorded in September 2023. We talked about studio space business models, the financial pressures of being an artist, how to avoid the risks of gentrification and art washing, and then there was also a conversation about pricing things according to their true cost. So it was quite a wide-ranging discussion. And then there was a slight moment of embarrassment for both me and Nicole as we tried unsuccessfully to create a visual metaphor for 40,000 square feet, so stay tuned for that. But I began the conversation by asking Nicole to tell us the founding story of Second Floor Studios and Arts.
So we're in our 27th year, operational year, I believe. Second Floor Studio and Arts came about because the founder, Matthew Wood, and his co-founder, Kelvin Omard, needed space to deliver theatre at the stage, because Second Floor Studio and Arts, the arts is a theatre piece. Mm. And they started hiring buildings. They were hiring more buildings than they needed. So they had some extra rooms. They carved them up into studios. Matthew's also an artist and a ceramicist, and it just evolved from there. It's that kind of classic founder model that's very common in our sector. And it's sort of, you know, it's evolved over time. When I met Matthew, he was running the largest single site project in London, which was in Woolwich. And I then got involved in the project. I think many people know that Matthew had quite a serious brain injury back in 2013. So when he had needed to take a step back, I then came forward, and that's where I became chief exec of Second Floor Studio and Arts Limited. And also we've formed a community interest company as well, because we find with the way that Second Floor operates, depending on who we're partnering with, be it a developer or be it a council, different company vehicles better suit those relationships. Mm. But fundamentally, we provide affordable workspace for visual artists, fine artists, crafts and designer makers. Right. We are quite open in who we accept into the studios. We don't make a judgment on anyone's work. So we have a real wide ranging group of practitioners with us. And we are really focused on delivering. We used to do meanwhile, but we do so very, very unlikely these days. We've got one project that's meanwhile, but what we're trying to do is work on legacy and perpetuity.
And when you say meanwhile, just for any listeners out there who are not familiar with what that means in this context, can you sort of explain what that means?
Yeah, so development cycles in London used to be about 10 years. So someone would say to you, here's an end of life building. Is it of any use to you for the next 5+ years while I go through the planning cycle? And we would go, yeah, great. We'd come in, we fit it out. So we'd run it for 5 years, up to 10 years, depending on planning cycles. So that's meanwhile, because you're using it for a while it's between mean use switches. So, but the planning cycles now are much tighter, and developers obviously don't want to be sitting on land and not getting a revenue out of it. So meanwhile now, I mean, I had someone, classics, they bought an office block and it was 50,000 square feet. And you suddenly get excited because, like, oh, that's really interesting. And they're like, yeah, you can have it for 18 months. You're like, by the time I've fitted it out, put people in it, and I'm decreasing it again, it's no use to anyone. And unfortunately, with the climate crisis that we're in, meanwhile space, often that fit out ends up in landfill and it's not good use of materials.
And can we just sort of dwell a little bit on the model for second floor studios, as well as artist studio providers more generally? So I think for a lot of lay people who, you know, are interested in the arts but aren't familiar with where artists work, this might be a slightly foreign, new idea, new kind of concept. So can you explain what your relationship is between artists and developers, maybe? What problem do you solve in the world in London, for example?
Okay.
And how does it work exactly?
Okay, so the big questions. Okay, fundamentally, as second floor studio and arts, and personally, I believe that our culture and our society is better for having artists in it. Mm-hmm. And cultural context within which we associate a sense of place isn't just through anchor organizations like galleries and education spaces. You know, you think of Camden, you think about atmosphere, you think about sensory elements. It's quite likely artists have created those sensory elements. So philosophically, you first of all have to take a decision of, do artists matter in culture? And we believe they do. And then you have to look at their life cycle and what happens within their universe to be able to understand what resources they need to support their function. And through my thesis research that I did at my master's, fine artists and applied artists tend to earn about £6,000 a year from their practice.
Yeah.
Makers, it's more like 11,000 a year. So what they're then having to do is build portfolio careers around that, because their cost base is about 20,000 a year in terms of living in London, which is really tight. And there aren't many of us that are really getting by on 20,000 a year in London. That's tight, but that's where they're at. So if you take that is their income position, you know, they would be people that would be eligible for social housing. So why aren't they eligible for social workspace? And that's effectively where we come in, like a third sector, understanding the parameters within which they're operating and then giving them affordable workspace, because we believe they have value in the context of society. And the way that we do that is that we take on buildings, we carve them up into self-contained workspaces that fall below the VOA threshold, so they don't attract business rates. And we rent them out on flexible terms to visual artists, fine artists, crafts and designer makers. Does that explain your question?
Yeah, I think it does. And what is the VOA threshold that you refer to?
The Valuation Office, the Valuation Authority, depending on which government's coming in and how it flexes, but basically £12,000, if a single hereditament, so a self-contained unit, has a perceived value of rent of less than £12,000 a year, it doesn't have to pay business rates.
Right.
And that is absolutely critical to our sector, because you can't charge an artist rent and then go, by the way, you've got to pay another 40% to the council on business rates. So that really does, it's such a critical factor within the way that we look at our business model.
So that affects the size of the spaces that you're able to offer.
Well, I can't go much over, in zone two, I can't go much over about 340 square feet. Whereas in Seven Oaks, I could do something that's 600 square feet, because it's a completely different valuation. Out in High House Production Park, Purfleet, where we're trying to bring forward a massive maker's site, I can do a studio that's about 550 square feet before I hit those thresholds, because the valuations are different. Mm-hmm.
And can you give us just an overview of how these opportunities for space come about? So how might you uncover an opportunity for a block of artist studios? How does that opportunity come about?
It's kind of three routes, I guess, really. There's there's just buildings listing. You know, we had a really interesting one come through this week. Literally, you're just on email lists for commercial property agents. A lot of really fruitful conversations to come through with developers, really early doors on developers. There's not much point coming into a scheme when it's been built because it's not fit for purpose. It's not designed for you. And then you're not getting the value engineering in the process that you really want. But developers is a key relationship. And the last one is working with councils closely. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of councils who have property assets that they have to retain. They can't asset transfer and they have to bring into use. Based on policy decisions, and it's working in relationship with them to bring forward buildings in a way that reflects the needs of their local community and society.
Right, that makes sense. And how many sites does Second Floor currently have, and where are they?
So we're quite unusual. We own 63% of our property portfolio. So we have a large site in Deptford. We have a rental that we work on with Hyde Housing, you know, an affordable housing developer. We've got a site there. We work with Quintain up at Wembley Park, and we are going to be doubling our size there next year. That's Secret Squirrel stuff at the moment. So no one on this call is allowed to pass that on yet. The ink's just about to go down on the contract. And we have a site in Sevenoaks, which is a joint venture with Sevenoaks District Council. And next year we are growing our portfolio by another 43, 45%. We're at Wembley Park, and then we have a new site coming forward in the Royal Borough of Greenwich, but I can't be more specific than that.
That's exciting. So a lot of opportunities on the horizon for you.
Yeah, they take years to bring into fruition.
Yeah,
it's a slow burn. That's something I've really, really learned over the last decade of working in this sector, is just how slow everything takes as soon as property gets mentioned. And you just have to be patient, and that's really difficult to be patient if you're in the situation that I was with you in 2016, where we were a studio provider without any studios, and you're like, we really need the revenue to come in, we need to get the studio project open, and it's property life cycles, which are really quite slow and painful.
Yeah, and very long term. And what kind of artists and creatives do you have at your site? So can you give our listeners a flavour of the kind of work that takes place in the studios that you guys manage?
This is the thing I find absolutely fascinating. We create these little white boxes, and then people go in and just have these amazing explosions of talent and creativity. And it's open studios is a fantastic thing to behold, because you go into all these different rooms and they're completely mind-blowingly different. And I'd recommend anyone, if you know, open studios are free. It's such a nice way to spend a couple of hours at the weekend. And we've got Wembley Park open studios this weekend, and then Sevenoaks the weekend after that. But the kind of artists that we've got, so, you know, we have a blend. If I take the Foundry as an example, so we've got starter studios there. So we've got recent graduates. We've got the main studios. We've got ground floor studios, which has got makers in it. And then we've got creative industry, because we had to make the finances work in the round. So we have a 20%, which are creative industry. So creative industry, I might have someone like Lucy Hardcastle, who's doing the most amazing rendered graphics for people like Adidas and Nike. And she's doing the most phenomenal renderings. And then a couple of doors down in conservation, I've got Mark Padgett, who's working for Bonhams and Sotheby's and Christie's, working on multi-million pound paintings and restoring them. And then he's next door to a painter who is, you know, an emerging artist, and, you know, she's trying to kind of progress her work. And then you've got someone that's doing ceramics downstairs and sculpture. We've got Matt Hope with us. He's quite well known for his chandeliers, his NOS chandeliers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the little NOS canisters.
He
goes around collecting them, and he makes them into these most phenomenal chandeliers.
Wow.
And
I've not come across that.
He won a European Design Award for them. They're just beautiful. And there's different types of NOS. Some of the canisters are pink and some of them are slight green colour because they're medical grade, I guess.
Mm.
And then, you know, you've got potters throwing the most phenomenal stoneware for some of the best restaurants in London, you know, and they're just throwing out, you know, 100 plates at a time. And then you've got slipware and you've got sculpture. You know, we had a talk this week by Enrique Proud Bears Red. about his sculptural works with a group of patrons that came to site, you know, and his the philosophical kind of elements that he's working on, the way he brings into his work. You know, it's just amazing the breadth of talent and the breadth of conversation that these people are having through visual arts. It's really inspiring.
So it's a real kind of gamut of art forms across the visual arts. And to be honest, I mean, I have visited the Foundry, I think, when you guys first opened. And whenever I visit studio spaces, I'm really blown away by the variety of creativity and talent and workmanship that happens in these places. And it feels quite utopian almost, because you hope that in the future maybe we can all have opportunities to work like this and alongside different disciplines. So that's really great. And so you mentioned the open studios. How frequently does that happen? Is that sort of once a month at each of your sites? So if people
Gosh, my studio members will hang me if I ask them to do it once a month. It's an annual undertaking, right? Because we do require everyone to participate. There's nothing worse than saying, come to open studios and come and see our closed corridors. You know, if someone's made the effort to come to site, we want them to have a great experience. Yeah. So we do insist on everyone opening. So we only make that kind of demand on studio members once a year.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. So I guess keep an eye out on your website.
The dates are already up for Deptford next year in May, so everyone can pencil that already for their diary. But it's a lovely way, because these are private workspaces. Yeah. So this is the only opportunity really that you get to kind of step inside and see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. We've got a question from one of our listeners today, Stephen, who asks whether do you ever have problems with getting tenants in? Or is the main issue with actually finding the spaces and buildings to house them?
Okay, demand is exceptionally high and it's getting worse. Mm. We are oversubscribed 4-1 on all of our studios, which is a very comfortable position to be in terms of the supplier of the space. But I think it speaks volumes to the problems that we have within, particularly within London, in that we just have a massive under-resourced supply. Mm-hmm. There is not enough supply to go around. And, you know, I was speaking to someone just this week. I did a studio viewing with someone, a painter. She's not even moved into London yet, but she's already securing her studio because she's, some of the studio providers start even replying because they have nothing. Mm. We're different. We run an inquiry list rather than a wait list. Mm. There are some people that literally have been on the wait list and they're moving up one by one for the last sort of 5 years. We run a bit more of a dynamic process than that. We're just on an inquiry list, and as soon as we list a studio, we put it up on a predefined kind of live link, and people can see that we've put it up and they can come and see the space. But the challenge is getting the projects online because of the costs involved in bringing a project forward. Mm. That is the challenge. And it's financing the sites and getting them at sufficient scale. There's a new piece of planning policy in London that kind of is a nudge in the right direction, but it's not there yet in terms of what it's delivering, and we're starting to see some of the hiccups with the conception of the policy. Mm. So if you're a developer and you're bringing forward, let's say for argument's sake, a 300 something dwelling apartment block, you whatever square footage that creates, you've got to give 10% assigned to affordable workspace.
Yeah,
that might only be 3,000 square feet, and you cannot deliver anything meaningful in 3,000 square feet once you've allowed for a kitchenette, a wash up and a toilet. The actual space you've got left to carve up into studios is not viable. And unfortunately, depending on which council you're working with, they don't let a developer aggregate those across projects. Mm-hmm. So the challenge you've got is finding projects of sufficient size, and you won't get anything within zone 2 now that is, 40,000, 50,000 square feet, unless something exceptional has happened in the planning.
And Just to give our listeners a sense of scale, what is 40,000 square feet or 50,000 square feet? Is there a sort of maybe a football pitch analogy that you can use or something?
Oh, I'd have to get Googling really quickly on that. I'm not in an office, so I can't get one of my colleagues.
Or actually, maybe a better analogy would be, say, a Tesco Express or a Sainsbury's local. How much square footage do you think is in a typical...
40,000 square feet, what does that look like? So it's a building that's probably about 300 meters long and about three stories high.
Right.
Would be about 40,000 square feet. 300 meters? Do I mean 300 meters? No, that's too long. No, rubbish. I don't know is the easy answer to that.
This will be for anyone listening out there who can do really quick maths and is really sort of spatially...
Rachel Green, you're on this call. Can you bring out some sort of decent...
Get your tape measure out. Why do you think there is a crisis of affordable workspace? I suppose there are a number of ways you can begin to tackle that question, but maybe actually to start with a really basic premise, why do artists still want to come to London? Maybe that sounds like a very kind of naive, stupid question, but just... Can you spell that out for us? Like, what is the appeal of London as a early career artist?
So I asked that question as part of my thesis research because I was like, why are you struggling? Why are you staying in London when you can go and have a much better quality of life outside of London and afford more, blah, blah, blah. And it seems to be a confluence of things. So it seems to be that, you know, you've got some really exciting education institutions and you've got a cohort of about 2,500 coming out every year from art schools. So you can see what's coming through in terms of what's the latest thinking from an age perspective. You've got the big institutions in terms of the galleries and what they're doing. You've got everything in between on the smaller galleries, but you've got peer networks. And that's ultimately, I mean, I know a few people that have gone to Margate and they've come back, you know, that whole kind of, you know, there was this thing about 5 years ago that everyone's going to go and, you know, go to Margate and there's a mass exodus. Everyone's come back.
Right.
Because of the connectivity, and just the energy. London has an energy and it's infectious and it is inspiring and it's got this kind of gritty underbelly as well as being shiny. And you need both sides of that to make for interesting cultural interactions. And, you know, the journey you can go on in an evening in London is just fantastic. You can go to some amazing theatre, you can go and see some comedy, you can go and catch three shows. I mean, the intensity is why people are in London, because they just feel disconnected when they're not involved in it. And I think as an established practitioner, you can successfully exit from London and still be extremely relevant and valued, but I think you have to establish your point of conversation and your point of influence before you do that.
Right, that's interesting. So that's the demand side. And on the supply side, I suppose we're all familiar with the housing crisis, you know, when it comes to residential property. To what extent does that spill over or is reflected in the demand, in the supply for commercial property?
You're right. You have extreme pressure on property in London, and you have intensification of use. So the site that our foundry project is on used to be Printworks. It was a triangle between two railway lines that was Printworks, and it was industrial land. And a developer bought it up and convinced Lewisham Council to enable them to turn it into a mixed-use site. And Lewisham had great foresight in saying, actually, you can, but you've got to put back the commercial. And we'd encourage you to make it affordable because we don't think there's going to be other commercial uses for that area. So you have this kind of... And we were really lucky with the developer that we worked with, Anthology, that they got that we were a soft commercial solution that would support the value of their residential. So that works, but that is rare, that you get a developer that will invest in bringing something substantial in at the ground floor, because everything is driven by the profitability of the residential. And and unless they're specifically instructed as part of the planning process to put in a big quantum of commercial, they just won't.
Right.
And that's the supply challenge, is that you've then got, you know, we were fortunate, we bought under what they call a Section 106, which is where developers have to put back into the community, and that vehicle is called a Section 106, sort of in a very sort of layman's terms. But as a studio provider, because we charge affordable rents, we don't cash accrue. And if you don't cash accrue, you can't then put down massive deposits to buy sites.
Right.
And that's where the whole funding finance piece is so critical to this sector. Because if you want to secure a property and you want to take assets into effectively community ownership, you need the right finance houses and the right structure to support those acquisitions. And they are very tricky to bring forward with the current available resources to us.
So to play that back, the issue being an affordable studio provider is that you don't accumulate cash as a private developer or a private landlord might do, which means that you can't then be quick off the bat in seizing opportunities for taking on further properties.
Yeah.
And so you're reliant on maybe grants or sources of affordable finance, like social investment, for example, to then take advantage of those opportunities.
Yeah, because if you're going to charge affordable rent, really all you're covering is your cost base.
Mm-hmm.
You might have a small margin in there that you kind of put to one side for emergencies, you know, if the roof goes. But the idea is that you're not in existence for profit. You're in existence to create value.
Mm.
And if you're not in existence to create profit, you're not cash accruing, which means that when an opportunity presents itself where you could buy a site, we're looking at one at the moment, a really large size. And we can't go to, when you're looking at buying a site, you have also what you call, when you get into commercial mortgage land, what they call a loan to value ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to really, if you're in affordable sector, you have to be at a 60-40 LTV. If you've got 60% borrowing, the only way to create 40% equity within the asset is to put cash down, or you've bought it under market value, or both.
Yeah.
And to put cash down, you need to have cash accrued. And if you haven't cash accrued, that's not an option available to you. So the only option then is that you've bought below market value through a vehicle like a Section 106.
Right.
But really what you need to do is be able to cash, is have a lump sum to put in on the purchase to achieve the loan to value ratio and to make your borrowing less.
Yeah.
And that's what we as a sector have been asking the GLA for I think it's the best part of 20 years now. We've been asking them for seed funding that they effectively give us a chunk of money, like say 500,000. And we are in the legal framework would be they give us that money and then we agree to buy it out about 7 to 10 years later at a pre-agreed position, because ultimately the history shows that property increases in value. So you should be able to mortgage out 7 to 10 years later whatever you borrowed in that seed funding. And that's the piece that is really unsexy for those that do the finance, because it's a big chunk of money that's put to one side and you don't see it again for 7 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So it's not what people want to be offering us, but it's what we really need.
Yeah. So just to play that back again for our listeners, because I appreciate that, you know, there's a few kind of financial concepts being discussed here. So the idea is that you would have a sympathetic funder who'd lend you, say, £500,000. You would use that to take on property and develop property, hold on to it for 7 to 10 years, see the appreciation in value, and then there'd be a mechanism by which that seed funder could cash out with a bit of profit. Or a bit of return on their initial investment.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah.
And do you see that, has that model ever been attempted in, well, maybe in other parts of the UK or anywhere abroad? I guess there's a broader question there about creative solutions to this challenge of providing affordable workspace to artists around the world.
I haven't seen it as a model. I mean, they do some quite interesting stuff in Canada, but that's more that they underwrite the studio provider so they can take on large buildings. So that's an underwrite position rather than a cash position, but they do underwrite So that people can get in. So they used to have a really big fashion district, and they've got these phenomenal warehouses, which would make fantastic studios because they're got great windows down the side. They're not too wide. You just basically put a central corridor down, and you see the local government underwriting the studio providers. And they've not had, last time I looked, they've not had one fail. So there are people that are doing some quite creative stuff. The worst thing you could do as a solution is add in an extra layer of cost.
Mm-hmm.
So there are concepts that have come out of the GLA which add an extra of cost layer of cost into the process, and that's not helpful at all.
And just in terms of, we've been talking a lot about affordability in this sector. Who decides what's affordable?
So we've come up with this question a lot. I say we. So Second Floor Studio and Art, Space, ASC, some of the big studio providers in London, we all came together and went, what is affordable? And actually, we're finding that we want to control the narrative, and we are the experts in the sector, and we want to be the voice of the sector. So we form something called LASN, which is London's Affordable Artist Studio Network.
Mm-hmm.
And between us, we represent 1 million square foot of space in London, and we represent 1 in 3 artists, as in that we house 1 in 3 artists in London. So LASN has formed, and it's basically an alliance of chief execs. And it's been really helpful because we are discussing things like EPC certification that's coming forward. We're discussing how we're finding that councils are asking us more and more to provide community services rather than just the space. And we've looked at affordability. And in London now, I'm really sad to say, but affordable is now £20 a square foot and anything below that. It used to be about £13. But the way that we're now trying to get into asset ownership, we cannot deliver space at sort of £12 a square foot when we've got such large mortgages on acquisitions that we're making. So we're finding that now it's you know, anything that's below £20 a square foot, someone can join LASN as an organisation.
Mm-hmm.
If they've got 80% of their projects that are below £20 a square foot. But that's the position at the moment. And we were really surprised. Between us, we all did some aggregates. You know, we did some aggregating of our rent positions. And we were actually quite surprised that on aggregate, because there were a couple of buildings that, for whatever reason, were costing us so much more to run, maybe because leases were up for renewal and we had to run those renewals. And so the rent had gone up. But in our aggregate position is somewhere between £18 and £20. But it's something it's not a percentage below market rates.
Mm.
And it's so important not to go into that narrative of a percentage below market rate. It doesn't mean, I'm not going to swear, it doesn't mean anything to say below market rates. You know, I have gifted, and Matthew have gifted, because it's our limited company. We don't have to make these choices.
Mm.
Foundry, we have given back to society since we opened the Foundry in 2019, £3 million in undercharged rents. So we could have charged £35 a square foot, but our mean there, I think, is about 17. So if you kind of extrapolate that out, we've gifted into the community £3 million in uncharged rents, because we would not fill it with artists at £35 a square foot. Could I fill it with architects potentially, you know, industry, but that's not the positioning that we choose. But yeah, affordability, you have to look at bottom-up pricing. And I go back to those stats I gave before about a fine artist, applied artist at £6,000 a year and a maker at £11,000 a year. You have to price up from that position, bottom-up pricing.
Yeah. And is there any kind of regulation around this? Should there be, you know, should we have more specific concrete definitions around what affordable is? Do you think that would help?
I'd like to see it, and a lot of people back away from it because they think, oh well, you know, Chelsea's really expensive, and you know, Haringey is something different. And if you go to bottom-up pricing, you can state what is affordable. You can. So yes, I would like to see more conversation about genuine numbers. And there are some councils that are doing some really interesting things around workspace strategies. And they're basically saying, if as a space provider you want council support in grants or other or another form, this is the price range you need your end users to be experiencing your spaces at. And there are some workspace strategies, but they are by borough by borough. They're not
across
like
London.
In the London plan.
Yeah. To what extent is this issue affecting other cities in the UK?
Through working with networks like CWN, I think
what,
there
sorry,
is...
Sorry, what's that? What's CWN?
Creative Workspace Network. There are challenges and pressures that are starting, you know, everything that we've been experiencing in London is starting to hit the major cities. I mean, there are great space providers like Wasp Studios up in Scotland and East Street Arts in Leeds. You know, they're doing amazing things, and they've perhaps been able to secure a bit more of their property than the guys in London have. But it's interesting getting onto calls and hearing them. You know, we've been supporting Bath Studios. Bath Studios, you know, didn't take. Perhaps weren't that concerned when they had an opportunity to buy the site and didn't. And then it got bought by a developer who's decided to move them on. And they're like, oh, no, no, we've been here 25 years. And you're like, yeah, but... And you can see that there are some artistic organisations that are being caught out by land sale and developers and development cycles, and they're not getting in on the conversation, and they're not being protected by councils because perhaps they haven't lobbied for themselves. So I think the encouragement, if there's anyone that's listening to this that is not in London, is start lobbying now with your MP, your local councillors, your local community, so that if there is a development cycle that's coming your way, that for whatever reason, you are put back into the new scheme, because you won't be able to stop the development from happening. You can't stop the wheels of change, but you can make sure that you are reprogrammed back into that change.
Right. So there's an interesting comment from Stephen, one of our listeners, suggesting that it would be interesting to use bottom-up pricing to learn what rents for normal retail on our high streets should be, you know, to allow bakers, butchers, independent businesses to run viable businesses in towns. I think it's a really interesting question.
I think we've got to stop market thought. You know, I mean, I trained as an economics. I understand free market. I get it. But it is failing us. And it is failing our high streets. And we have to make the argument for bottom-up pricing. And because we get so distorted by, you know, the 1% and their wealth position, the distortion is quite profound. And the only way we can stop it is to take that out of the aggregate position and bottom up price.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because I suppose we often talk about paying what the market rate is. You know, should that be the overriding principle of economic organization? So what someone is prepared to pay for something rather than how much it actually costs to produce something. I appreciate that it's probably not as simple as that.
But that's how you get into retail, curious. Isn't it? That's how you get into the troubles that we're in with the fashion industry. Because people are used to paying £5 for a t-shirt because it's been made in a sweatshop. Because that's how capitalism drives it. But that's not ethical pricing. And we have to get into ethical bottom-up pricing, however you want to call it, wherever you want to structure it. But you've actually got to look at what it costs, which is why, you know, if we had the resources, we'd be looking at being a B Corp.
Just pausing the recording there to explain what a B Corp is to listeners that might be unfamiliar. So the B, I think, stands for benefit, and the B Corp designation originated in the US, and it's now a globally recognized kite mark for social enterprises. According to the B Corp website, the B Corp certification is a designation that a business is meeting high standards of verified performance, accountability, and transparency on factors from employee benefits and charitable giving to supply chain practices and input materials.
Because you have to look at how your activity is impacting not just the bottom line. It's that kind of, you know, having a bottom line that actually takes in the environment into account, the environment.
Triple bottom line.
Triple bottom line. You know, it's we've got to be more enlightened in how we approach solutions.
Right. And I mean, as one of the sort of avenues of which to think about the climate crisis, it feels like we ought to be pricing in the cost of a lot of that, you know, of all of those environmental externalities into our supply chains and into our, you know, products and services. So yeah, that's an interesting idea. I didn't really think that we'd, you know, talk about the idea of bottom-up pricing through affordable studio space provision.
But it's so important as a conversation, because it then really brings into real clarity what the price point should be. Because everyone's like, oh, it's very difficult. Because, you know, if you've got these factors and you've got those factors, like, it's not difficult. It's really actually very simple if you take the right approach and you apply the right econometric modeling to it, which is bottom up, and then you get to your price position.
I just want to change gears a little bit and talk about the relationship that artists and clusters of artists have with local communities. I think we've seen sometimes accusations of gentrification and, you know, claims that through working closely with developers, studio providers who bring in artists to a community, then they're at the vanguard of gentrification. What would you say to that?
So I think if you look at gentrification and how it's kind of been perceived, it's the idea that you're switching out working class for middle class. You're moving the gentry up a gear. That is gentrification. And I think post-World War II, you saw a lot of intensification into centres of cities with neglect to the urban areas. But as we're seeing the pressure go up in the inner cities, those urban areas are being revisited with investments. And that investment into urban development is what is causing the displacement. And I think what's important is that there isn't that displacement. Whatever you design back in, I mean, you're right to be knocking down, you know, buildings that are not fit for purpose. And were conceived to be these utopia, massive, you know, skyscraping towers. People actually want to live at a human level. So you take them down, but it's how you retain communities while developing. And, it, you know, I'm not against development as long as it's not art washing and greenwashing and all that kind of stuff that, you know, gets thrown around. So I think artists will gravitate towards affordable workspace, and it has been in these kind of suburban or kind of commercial, neglected commercial areas. And they have made, and you know, this I think is a really interesting thing, because everyone talks about how much, you know, and maybe at Hackney Wick the artist made it this really amazing, interesting place. But then if you bring in vanilla development and get rid of the artists, it's no longer an interesting place. So why would you not bring them back into the cycle and make allowance for them to keep the vibrancy of the place?
Well,
I think it's artists are occupying spaces that are underutilized, and that makes them more attractive when developers come in. But then you have to have the sense in the policy decisions that you don't lose that vitality and that vibrancy by having those artistic communities in place.
Yeah, and also not alienating the local residents, the local community. And it feels like there's an opportunity there for those creatives, for those artists to bring the community on board through, for example, things like open studios.
Yeah.
I wonder whether there are any other kind of ways in which, maybe through your experience, that you can bring the community on board. This connection between art, culture, and community, art's role in placemaking has been a bit of a theme in this podcast. So yeah, I would welcome your reflections on that.
It's, everyone's got really busy lives. And when we try and go out to the community and engage with them and encourage them to come and kind of experience an artistic event for free, we don't get swamped. It's quite a process. And what we found is, because we have something called the Shared Skills Time Bank, which is where each of our studio members pledges an hour of their time every month to Second Floor to to put out as internal mentoring between studio members or to use externally within the community. And it's something that got completely flattened, obviously, as an idea over COVID, but we're trying to revisit it. And it's really important that we don't just kind of helicopter in these ideas, that you actually build grassroots relationships. So actually what you need to do is you need to find a champion that's already in that community.
Mm-hmm.
And once you find them, you say, how can we work with you? And mm-hmm. what is missing and what would you like? And do we have anything that would be of interest to you? And you build those organic, natural relationships over the long term. I mean, we've got a little gallery in Deptford, and we have something called the Painting Open and the Drawing Open once a year. Basically, you just have to register for it. The first 100 people, their work gets hung. And it's been really lovely to slowly see local residents in Deptford come in and see the show because they've got a friend that's in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just those tiny little threads that you start pulling on that you hope will lead to something else. But it's also about having the resources to follow up those conversations and to, you know, we dedicated a whole month of the gallery in August a couple of years ago before COVID to a charity that came in and just ran children's workshops all day long for the surrounding residents. But I think we struggled to get sort of about 15 children to come to free creative workshops because there's not the trust and there's not that kind of understanding of why we're doing it, which is on us to, you know, how can we better communicate? And we feel as we go forward, particularly into 2024, and we've got some finance put to one side to build the Shares Kids Town Bank, is we need to find community champions and we need to find them where they are and then ask how we can work with them and support to build those bridges,
right.
And to build that understanding. Because, you know, the most exciting thing for me is if we have open studios and, you know, some 15, 16-year-olds walk in, they're not slamming STEM at school, but they love doodling and they're really creative. And they come in and they see Rod Hunt's studio and he's this illustrator that's just done the 4 Guinness World Record book covers and he's just done the Grand Prix circuit in, I think it was Saudi Arabia. You know, he's made an amazing living by being a creative and being an illustrator. And it's that connection of inspiration between generations that I would really like us to see work on. And to encourage people to follow their creative path if that's how they're feeling naturally biased.
I feel like there's a real opportunity with studio spaces to inspire young people. You know, we were talking earlier about the studio open days and how exciting it is to see lots of different artists. Yeah, but at the same time, arts education is being squeezed out of schools. So, I don't think there's a quick fix solution here, but it feels like where you have studio spaces in a town, you know, or a place, it really makes sense to try and like get as many young people to visit and see in a, you know, in an hour, you could probably see a number of different art forms. And
I think school tours would be something we'd really welcome.
Yeah.
Whenever we reach out to schools, they're under-resourced, and the logistics of getting kids through and health and safety and everything else. But we did some really interesting stuff over COVID. We did online sessions where we would have an artist present their work in their studio. The teacher would then use that as a starting point for the class to respond and do something in the style of the artist they'd just seen with their work and then present back to the artist at the end of the day. And that was a really nice little piece to kind of, and for just those young minds, just to see that there are other options than STEM subjects, which absolutely. I know has been pushed quite hard.
Do you think there's also a challenge around the fact that most people know what a theatre is? Most people know what a museum is or what to expect from a museum or an art gallery. But the idea of artist studios is probably not that obvious to someone not, you know, from the arts world. So how many people really understand how art gets made and where it gets made and the importance of organizations like yours that provide that space?
Yeah, and I think something I think to bring in here as well is around diversity.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking with someone who's sort of early 20s who comes from an ethnic minority, and she was saying to me, it was never in my radar what a studio was and studio provision, and I wouldn't know that that would be the next step. That so I would go to art school and then I would need a studio, and she's just like, it wasn't in my sphere of experience.
And
I was like, no, you're right, I get that, I hear you. And I think we've experienced that over at Wembley Park when we opened. Wembley Park has a phenomenal community, and it's very, very diverse. And our studios initially weren't representing that community, mm-hmm. but they are now. We now have 60% local postcodes, and in terms of the who's on site, it absolutely reflects the local community, because it took the community about 5 years to work out who we were,
right.
and why we were there. And it's when a local person got a studio and then talked to their friends. But those things take, it's taken 5 years to get to that position. And I think the diversity element is really important in terms of education as well, and how you plant those seeds of this is what you will need to take your practice forward. And we're seeing it in our starter studios. We've got some really brilliant people that have just come in on the new, because they've recently just graduated. And we are seeing more diversity come through into the sites. But it is something that I think also needs to be proactively looked at.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds great. And so what's next for Second Floor Studios and Arts?
Oh, Matthew and I were having a strategy meeting yesterday. We were going, so in 10 years time, we'll be 60. How do we feel about that? We're growing about another sort of 45% next year, which is good. We would like to bring forward another couple of really big sites, because you get economies of scale once you get, you get the sort of the 30,000 square feet upwards. So there's a big site that we're looking at in London that would be about 45,000 square feet. And we're trying to bring forward, we've had this brilliant architect called Andrew McMullen and his team design with us up to Reba Stage 2, a makers focused building, because mm-hmm. makers are getting pushed out of London, because with the mixed use schemes, you can't have stone masonry and glass blowing and sculpture at the ground floor, because it upsets the residential. You have to curate who you allow on the ground floor. So we want to house makers on the High House production park out in Purfleet, to just a building for them. And that would be a really big project to bring forward, but it requires about 10.5 million to bring into being, and we can only finance about a 25% of that. So the rest has to come through grants, philanthropy, leveling up funds, however it's going to be in the mix. So that again is one of those things that we know we've got a brilliant building, we know we've got a really good concept. It's up to Reba Stage 2, thanks to the Creative Estuary giving us some money to kind of work on that, but it's not ready to go because the finance isn't there.
Yeah.
But if you get a couple of those really big projects and they're assets that you own, you then underpin the company and the organization. And you can then potentially look yourselves to borrow lending to another studio provider to give them the seed funding that I mentioned before to secure their building. Because I think that's what you need to do as an organization if you want to be responsible, is you look at who else you can help that's behind you. You don't look out for yourself. You look out for who else is trying to do what you're doing.
And build the ecosystem.
Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense. Over the last 18 months, with the price of borrowing kind of going through the roof, inflationary pressures following, war in Ukraine and the wider kind of macroeconomic context, has it been harder to find the finance to actually build the schemes because of the costs of, materials? Has it created
disastrous.
A crunch?
Yeah. It's been disastrous. Our fit out per square foot has gone from 43 to 65.
Wow.
And I've just had to walk away from buying a site that I'd already invested £7,000 in illegals and architect mm-hmm. fees. I've had to walk away because the bank are requiring us to stress test at 10%.
That's kind of unheard of in recent years, right?
Yeah, but that's what the bank are requiring us to stress test at. So this site would have brought in about £12,600 a month in revenue. Mm-hmm. My finance would have cost nearly £11,000 a month.
Right, so it's just unviable.
So you either go to the developer and go, you need to drop your price by like half, and you go to the bank and go, can you do me a staggered mortgage? So you say, okay, I'm borrowing $1 million, but I'm going to pay back 500,000 in the next 25 years. And then there's going to be a balloon that we're going to refinance at the end of it. It's just horrible.
Yeah.
And that is a project that has been lost because of market factors, because of everything that's happening right now. We would be opening 3 projects next year, but we're not.
To end on a slightly more maybe positive, more interesting note, not that that wasn't interesting, that is really interesting. I just kind of, you know, yeah, I don't want to end on that note, basically.
I can show you my dogs. They're all 3 of them are sat here if you want to have like a kind of a dog montage.
Well, if you could get them to bark, maybe you'll make a noise for our listeners, and that'll be good.
Don't encourage them. They've been good as gold. One's been snoring quite loudly. I hope you haven't heard that, but anyway.
No, not at all.
So go on, your last question. Go on.
Well, my last question was actually, I know you said that you trained in economics.
Yeah.
Did you have a creative practice before getting into this world? And what was that? Because I don't think I've ever asked you that question.
Yeah, so drawing is my thing.
Right.
I was tipped, as you know, as I won scholarships to go to schools based on drawing, etc. Right. But family dynamics meant that I needed to go and get a job. So I couldn't study art at university and I went and did economics.
What kind of drawing were you doing?
Pastels mainly.
Right.
Yeah, pastels. I can't get on with paint as a wet medium. It just escapes me. But drawing, I can kind of, I love colour. I'm a real colourist. A lot of people, I mean, I'm not today because we're doing this, but normally I do what they call dopamine dressing. I'm sort of bright pink or bright yellow or bright blue, or I love colour. So drawing's my thing. So but I'm quite content that if I get to my sketch pad at 60 or 80 or doesn't matter, I think you can be an artist and have actually maybe more interesting things to say the more you've seen about life. So I'm quite content with facilitating everyone else's artistic careers right now, and I'm hoping that at some point it'll be my time.
Nicole, yeah, once again, thank you so much for taking part. It's been a real pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much for inviting me. And yeah, if there's any questions that kind of come, people will sort of seen this and they want to chat to me further.
Yeah.
I'm always available to try and help nudge people along in their own journeys and their own challenges that they're facing. And sometimes they just need to speak to someone that's done it.
Yes.
To give them that kind of courage to go, actually, let's jump and let's go and secure that community asset. And if I can help in any way, then just let me know.
Yeah, absolutely. I can attest to the fact that you're a real champion, I think, for the sector and a real, you know, expert. So there's a lot of wisdom that resides within
painfully
you.
Painfully won, so, yes.
Yeah. So definitely.
I don't recommend it. I really don't. You have to be a glutton for punishment. But yeah, that's the life of a social entrepreneur.
And that was our conversation. And this is now my unscripted freestyle outro. Thank you, Nicole, for taking part in the conversation. I thought it was really interesting and thought-provoking, and I hope that our listeners out there enjoyed it too. And I'm really grateful to the people listening for getting to the end, you know, and I hope that you found it interesting. Please feel free to share the podcast, you know, send a link to your friends, anyone that might be interested. We're really trying to build a bit of an audience for this show, if you can call it a show. I think it's just a conversation. And if you'd like to hear more information about the next episode, the next few episodes, please subscribe to our newsletter, and you can do that at the bottom of the Arts and Culture Finance website. Okay, I think that's it. I hope that you're doing well wherever you are, dear listener, and see you next time.